This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll take a look at two of Donald Trump's latest appointees for his second term.
First, we interview Scott Maxwell, a Florida reporter who has closely watched the career of Pam Bondi, whom Trump has nominated as the next attorney general.
We'll then discuss the newly chosen chair of the Federal Trade Commission, Andrew Ferguson, and what that could mean for big tech and antitrust laws.
Our guest is Laura Kilgore with the American Economic Liberties Project.
Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties. When Matt Gaetz, Donald Trump's first choice to be the next Attorney General of the United States, withdrew his name in the face of mounting controversy over his sex scandals, Trump wasted no time in announcing Pam Bondi as his second choice. Bondi, Florida's first woman attorney general for 8 years, from 2011 to 2019, was part of Trump's defense team during his first impeachment trial and supported his false claims of fraud following the 2020 election. She remained in Trump's orbit since then, continuing to advise him on legal matters. In announcing Bondi as his new choice, Trump signaled the role he expects her to play. Quote, "For too long, the partisan Department of Justice has been weaponized against me and other Republicans. Not anymore. Pam will refocus the DOJ to its intended purpose of fighting crime and making America safe again." Unquote. By fighting crime, Trump means going after his political enemies. Bondi has loyally promised that, quote, "When Republicans take back the White House and the Department of Justice, the prosecutors will be prosecuted, the bad ones, and the investigators will be investigated," unquote. Bondi is a partner at Ballard Partners, the lobbying firm that had been run by Trump's incoming chief of staff, Susie Wiles, and whose founder, Brian Ballard, is a top Trump fundraiser. She is co-chair of Law and Justice Division at the pro-Trump America First Policy Institute. Thrust onto the national stage, Pam Bondi is not a household name. To learn more about her, we went to an award-winning journalist in her home state of Florida. Scott Maxwell is a three-time-a-week columnist for the Orlando Sentinel. He joined the Sentinel newsroom as a reporter in 1998 and started writing his column in 2002. He has received awards from the Society of Professional Journalists, the Society of Newspaper Editors, and others. Before coming to Orlando, Scott wrote for the Winston-Salem Journal and the Chapel Hill Herald, after graduating from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill's School of Journalism. Scott, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
You've been following Pam Bondi since even before she was elected as Attorney General of Florida in 2011. Tell us your first impressions of her and your earliest contact with her.
Yeah, she is. When she first started running, she is not the Pam Bondi that I think most Americans would recognize today. In fact, she was actually a target of sort of hardcore right-wing zealots. She was divorced and did not have children. And so some of the right wing was attacking her, saying she wasn't going to be conservative enough to be attorney general in Florida. I actually at one point in time had penned a column sort of in defense of her, telling those folks to back off. And then I didn't really know her much, but she called me one night when she was still running. And she was desperate to win. It was a big race. And the backstory to that is Geraldo, who I'm sure you all are familiar with and your listeners, a host on Fox News, had his own show in the evenings. He was doing a story with Barry Scheck from the Innocence Project about a string of rotten convictions in Florida. I'll spare you and your listeners the drawn-out details, but it involves a dog handler who had claimed he had a tracking dog that could place suspects, really the bottom line is, wherever cops wanted this defendants to be placed. And he was exposed as a fraud, a total fraud in court, DNA evidence cleared, people that this dog handler had convicted. The problem was that after three people were convicted, this dog handler had been used to convict dozens of other people. So Barry Scheck from the Innocence Project and Geraldo agreed that all of those cases needed to be open. And they asked Pam Bondi if she wanted to come on the show and sort of be that crusader for justice. Well, of course, Pam Bondi wanted to get on national TV when she was running for attorney general. She had a problem, though. She didn't really know much about these cases. So she called me. I remember my wife and I were on our way to a charity fundraiser on a Saturday night. And I took the time to brief her on all of this, not because I wanted Pam Bondi to become Florida's next attorney general, but because I'd been writing about these cases for years and was having trouble getting anybody to care. And she said that she wanted to be that crusader. And she went on Geraldo that night. And she promised Geraldo, Barry Scheck, there are millions of viewers, and me, that if she got elected, she would crusade for the wrongly convicted, which I'm sure you guys know are sort of a lot of people that are whose crusades are normally ignored. And she got elected. And then she did absolutely nothing for those folks after she was elected. So that was my first sort of personal experience with Pam Bondi.
Scott, you actually broke the story over Bondi's involvement in the scandal involving Trump University. Give us the details about that, please.
Sure. And I imagine that's the story that a lot of your listeners are already familiar with. But if you go back about 10 years, there were complaints. They were sort of sizzling in a couple of states, New York and Florida. And these were basically about Trump University, which is the same way it's a university in the way that Taco Bell is actually a bell or something like that. I don't know. It was basically just a get-rich, I won't say scheme, but a get-rich academy where people would pay money, supposedly, to get advice from Donald Trump and learn how to make a whole lot of money. Well, a lot of people felt like they were getting scammed by Trump University, and they filed complaints in North Carolina and Florida. And we wrote about some of it. And there seemed to be some traction up in New York. But here in Florida, Pam Bondi and the attorney general before her, a guy named Bill McCollum, I should say, they really did nothing. And then I sort of forgot about it. But then when Pam Bondi was running for re-election as attorney general, some, I think, local blogger did a piece on all the celebrities that had donated to Pam Bondi. And one of the celebrities who had donated to Pam Bondi was Donald Trump. And that made the hair on the back of my neck stand up because I thought, wait a minute, she was just asked to investigate him. So I went back, tracked down the checks. What I found out was that 3 days after Pam Bondi's office publicly told our newspaper they were reviewing and investigating complaints against Trump University, Donald Trump cut Pam Bondi's campaign a check for $25,000, and then all of the complaints disappeared. Her office did absolutely nothing with them. Compare that to New York, where the attorney general took the exact same kind of complaints about being scammed and was able to net a $25 million settlement for folks up in that state. And you all are lawyers and know the sort of the ethics of law better than I do. But I think most people would tell you that under any definition, it'd be pretty improper for a prosecutor to take money from somebody who she had been asked to investigate.
As a quick follow-up, Scott, more recently, now that she's been nominated as Attorney General, has she or the Trump transition team responded to all the attention that that scandal is receiving?
You know, I think we're in sort of this, post-apocalyptic world where anything after Matt Gaetz looks actually pretty tame. I don't think she's faced a whole lot of questions more are about some of her lobbying activity, which I imagine we'll talk more about in a moment. But yeah, I think she will fake questions once she gets under there, and she absolutely should, because there's more to this story. For instance, the donation that Donald Trump cut to Pam Bondi back then, it was actually cut from the Trump Foundation, which is a charitable foundation, and that's illegal. Charities can't make donations to political campaigns. And for doing that, the Trump Foundation was fined. I can't remember exactly, several thousand dollars, I think it was. And ultimately shut down after that. And, you know, I'm sort of blah, blah, blahing over this stuff. But I think when you take a step back, the thing that's important to remember is this was real people and their life savings. In one case, a man said at Trump University, he invested $26,000 with the promise that Donald Trump would teach him how to make millions, and it drove him into bankruptcy. I found what Pam Bondi's office sent that man back. And while the New York Attorney General was pursuing justice, Pam Bondi's office sent that man back an email that suggested, and I quote, "He visit an internet search engine such as Yahoo or Google.com to search for information on class action lawsuits." So maybe that's what people are expecting in terms of protection, consumer protection from a prosecutor or attorney general. I would think not. And just to go a little bit further down the wormhole, you know, Pam Bondi's office claimed they had done some investigation into Trump University and they found nothing. Well, first of all, that sort of defies logic because in New York, they looked and they got $25 million in settlement. But I actually asked, I said, all right, give me every piece of paperwork you generated while investigating Trump University. And they hemmed and they hawed and we got our lawyers involved. And finally, they said, fine. And they gave me 8,491 pages of documents. My opinion of that was it was an attempt to sort of overwhelm me. And when I finally went through them, and it took weeks, if not months, it was a bunch of nothing. For instance, an email I sent them asking for those documents was included 39 different times. But I went through 8,400 pages, and there was nothing. There was absolutely nothing that showed that Florida had done any investigation. So I think as compared to New York, you can look and see that under Pam Bondi, Florida consumers paid a price.
Scott, did Pam Bondi face any accountability for her role in the scandal concerning Trump University?
You know, one of the first things I did was call the Florida bar, say, hey, this doesn't seem like too complicated of a question. Should you take money from someone you've been asked to investigate? The bar was very hands-off, as they often are, and didn't want to do anything. But an ethics complaint was actually filed. Florida has a laughingstock of an ethics commission. And people might think, oh, that's just that guy having his opinion. To prove that, the last chairman of our ethics commission had to resign because he was caught violating the state's ethics law. I mean, that's Florida in a nutshell. So this issue was filed with an ethics complaint, and the ethics commission did feel compelled to say that Pam Bondi taking money from Donald Trump after being asked to investigate Donald Trump, quote, may look suspicious, but they concluded she did nothing wrong. And one of the reasons they concluded she did nothing wrong is because, this part's pretty interesting, Pam Bondi claimed she did not know that her office was investigating Donald Trump. Now, this had been in the newspaper several times, and at one point in time when she was in sort of in a big gaggle of people who were saying, wait, you know, your office was looking at one of the highest profile business people, celebrities in America. It'd been all over the front pages, the newspaper. You're claiming you didn't know anything about it. One of the reporters, I think it was from AP or the Washington Post, said, well, when was the first time that you learned your office was investigating Donald Trump? And she took a big gulp and she said, when I read it in Scott Maxwell's column. And I guess I would say to that I do not believe that. I simply do not believe. But if I want to take her at face value, how sad would that be if your attorney general literally doesn't know who she's investigating until she reads about it in the newspaper?
Well, this is very revealing. Let's go through several key issues Bondi may face at her hearing and as attorney general if she's confirmed. What is her record generally on human rights issues, including LGBTQ issues?
That's a very good question. I think the issue that she most made the most attention with regards to equal rights does have to do with LGBTQ citizens, and it was pretty abysmal, at least in my estimation. Florida was one of the very last states in America that allowed same-sex marriage, one of the very last states in America to allow gay adoption, which, by the way, even if you're polling, most people from both parties think a child is better in a loving home than no home, regardless of what the parents are. But if you look at the arguments, Pam Bondi, see, what basically happened is the Supreme Court, you know, as you all know, made a ruling and basically said that it should be allowed. And then attorneys general had a choice and states had a choice. They could respect that or they could keep on fighting. And Pam Bondi kept on fighting. And if you look at some of the arguments she made, they're pretty primordial. She said that gay marriage in one of her, the filings should not be allowed because marriage was meant for couples to raise children in, quote, enduring family units. Now, let's flash back to what things we just talked about a moment ago. Pam Bondi was divorced when she ran. That was part of the reason I first started writing about her, was I thought it seemed a little caveman-esque to have all these men attacking her for being a divorced woman without children. You know, she obviously had sympathy for herself, but apparently not for same-sex couples, because that's, she said, marriage was not meant for them. And in a 2014 filing, she argued that gay marriage would, quote, impose significant public harm. And yeah, she cited, I mean, this is case law dating back to 1942. It was old school stuff. The Supreme Court ruling was in 2015. Florida did not green light this until 2016, and it was very much over the objections of Pam Bondi.
Scott, can you tell us about her stance on capital punishment?
Yes, she, like most politicians in Florida, are very much in favor of the death penalty. That is one thing where the general populace's opinion seems to be a little at odds with the politicians. But Pam Bondi is not only in favor of killing people, she's in favor of killing them as quickly as possible. In fact, she was a backer of something called the Timely Justice Act, which called for killing folks, you know, as quickly as possible with fewer appeals. You might have your own opinion on why that might be a good or a bad idea, but I'll tell you why I think it's a particularly bad idea in Florida, and that is because Florida is the state, as you all may know, that has more wrongful death penalty convictions than any other state in America. More times than anywhere else, we have wrongfully sent people to death row, and the state and prosecutors at the top have repeatedly rejected sort of safeguards, things like better rules on jailhouse snitches, how lineups are done, things like that, completely disregarded the ways to make convictions more accurate, and instead push for things like quicker executions. But there was one time when Pam Bondi did not push for a quicker execution, and this time she made national news. There was an execution for a family that was, I think a woman was, she was strangled, she'd been stabbed and left dead in a trash heap down in South Florida back in 1988, and that woman's killer had been convicted and on death row for a quarter century. And he was finally set for execution. And at the last minute, the execution was postponed. And nobody really understood in the public or the family why the execution had been postponed. Well, it turned out Pam Bondi, who wants to kill everyone as quickly as possible, had discovered she had a party that night. She had accidentally double booked a fundraiser for herself, I think at a waterfront home in Tampa Bay. And so records ended up revealing that she had asked the governor, Rick Scott at the time, if he would be so kind as to reschedule the execution that she normally wants to have very quickly at a time that didn't conflict with her campaign fundraiser. So that was the one time we saw Pam Bondi pump the brakes on an execution.
Well, maybe we've hit upon a new method of abolition. We need to keep inviting Pam Bondi to parties when people are scheduled to be executed. There are 40 people on federal death row. At the time of this recording, unless Joe Biden commutes those sentences, the Trump Attorney General will have the opportunity to play the same role that William Barr played toward the closing days of the first Trump administration, when 13 people, including one woman, were executed in the federal system. Based on everything you know about Pam Bondi's attitudes on capital punishment, what do you expect to happen in the new Trump administration regarding those executions?
Yeah, and I should start by saying that I'm not familiar with those specific cases. As you may know, I pay attention to the ones in Florida. But I think we can take from the story we just told and the very first story I told you about wrongful convictions, where Pam Bondi, on an issue where she went on national television and to get elected, promised to probe cases and never did. She's never displayed a sort of intellectual curiousness, about these, or look to overturn wrongful convictions if they exist. So that, coupled with her zeal for timely justice, as she calls it, I would expect Pam Bondi to be pretty enthusiastic about executing folks pretty quickly.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm Steve Rohde, and I'm joined by co-host Heidi Boghossian. What's Pam Bondi's record on investigating corporate fraud?
Yeah, and that is one where I think corporate America probably let out a pretty big cheer when Pam Bondi was nominated, because she's proven to be, in my estimation, pretty transactional, as we saw from that $25,000 donation from the Trump Foundation. But there was one of the earlier cases that I and a couple other reporters down here in Florida saw had to do with mortgage fraud that was going on. And you may remember that after the last recession, houses were being foreclosed upon all over the country, but there were a few states that were hit harder than Florida. Florida, Arizona, a couple others, the boom states. And a lot of those foreclosures were happening, you know, for just reasons, because people weren't paying their bills. But the evidence also showed that there were a lot of companies that were seizing, that were preying upon people who were really struggling to make ends meet, or were maybe making the minimum payments they needed to and improperly taking their homes. And that's what's known as the sort of foreclosure fraud industry. Well, in Florida, there were two women who worked for Pam Bondi who were really good at going after these frauds in the industry. In fact, they netted one of the biggest settlements. They netted $2 million from a company that improperly was foreclosing on Floridians. And you would think that would be great news. These women made headlines for being pit bulls on behalf of consumers. And yet, as soon as they started making headlines for being successful on behalf of consumers who'd been hosed by these companies, Pam Bondi forced them out. Her lieutenants forced them out. And one of the reasons they, it took a long time once again to get all the public records, but the women came right out and said, well, it's interesting that we got forced out because here's our job reviews. And their job reviews from just like, I can't remember, was there 2 or 3 weeks ago, but very close to that, were stellar. They were top notch. They were exactly what you'd think. So when they called them poor performers, it didn't really pan out. And when we got the records for why they were ousted, one of the reasons listed was that they demonstrated, quote, a lack of professionalism to opposing counsel. In other words, they weren't very nice to the fraudsters' attorneys. And that was one of the listed that was reasons listed for their ousting. The women, the investigators came forward and said this is, you know, crystal clear for anybody who wants to look at it. We did our jobs too well. We ticked off people in the industry and they were gone. And then after that happened, about the same time that happened, one of Bondi's senior officials left to go work for Lender Processing Services, which was one of the firms under investigation by the office. And the other thing that's worth noting for Floridians that's kind of sad is her chief, I think it was chief deputy at the time, a guy named Carlos Muniz, the one who helped justify the exodus of these very good foreclosure fraud investigators, is not only on the Supreme Court, he is now the Chief Justice of Florida's Supreme Court.
Scott, speaking of investigators, what do you make of Bondi's promise that, quote, the prosecutors will be prosecuted and the investigators will be investigated?
Yeah, I think that one probably, Heidi, you can draw your own conclusions, as with most listeners, but I think that's basically a campaign pledge. Pam Bondi was basically a litigator for Donald Trump in the court of public opinion. I've never been terribly impressed with their courtroom skills, but she's pretty good in the court of a public opinion. And she was the one who came out and defended him after January 6th. And I believe that is exactly what you would expect. They're vowing to go after the people who did the prosecuting. That's part of why some of them are leaving now, as we've seen this week. And I think she's vowing to do exactly what MAGA World wants her to do. We'll see. Sometimes they back off after they get on, but I'm sure you guys' insights on that are as good as mine.
Scott, she's going to have to face questions of ethics and conflicts of interest. We mentioned at the outset that she's a partner in the Ballard Lobbying Partnership. They represent Amazon, Uber, they've represented United Healthcare, TikTok, the GEO Group, which is the owner of private prisons, and the Justice Department is a major customer of GEO Group. One public interest organization, Revolving Door Project, said it is essentially impossible to organize a Justice Department ethically in light of the breadth of Bondi's connections. That individual, Jeff Hauser, said, "I think it is just going to be off the charts bad." Based on your long knowledge and observation of Pam Bundy and some of the examples you've already given us, how do you think she is going to respond to questions of conflict of interest? And do you foresee her building any kind of walls around her that will avoid those conflicts of interest?
Well, that's a good question, and let me take it in reverse order. Do I see her building any kind of walls? No, not in any meaningful way. In fact, I believe that's why much of corporate America is going to be thrilled to see her there, because they're not expecting her to do that. How do I think she'll respond? I think she'll say all the right things, or theoretically right things. You know, if you're asked, hey, you've done work for Amazon, Uber, and Qatar, are you going to do favors for Amazon, Uber, and Qatar once you're attorney general? You say no. I don't think it's going to get a whole lot deeper than that. I think there was a day when hiring someone who'd straight out of lobbying for clients that are going to have business or interest before the Justice Department, there would have been serious concerns. But man, we are in a new world order right now. I mean, this is on the heels of Matt Gaetz. Pam Bondi looks like Clarence freaking Darrow. And with Tulsi Gabbard coming in, I think she's pretty tame. So do I think she's going to get questions? Yes. Do I think she'll say the right things? Mostly. I don't think she's that quick on her feet if she faces a lot of tough grilling. We'll see that. But I just don't see much being a roadblock to her becoming the next AG.
Scott, there's a lot of talk of the incoming Trump administration retaliating against its enemies. Trump and others have included the press in that category. You sound like you've covered Pam Bondi without limits, without restraint, doing the kind of reporting and digging into the facts that we would expect from journalism. What motivates you as a journalist to cover public officials in this manner? Are you going to be intimidated in the next Trump administration?
So you're basically asking, and I appreciate the question, it's a good one. You're basically asking, you know, why does anybody go into journalism? And I think for me, it's to speak truth to power. There's an old adage that our job is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And I've always believed it's a journalist's job to tell the public what powerful people do not want to tell them. And if you look back at the stories that we've just talked about with Pam Bondi, it was trying to understand why there was no investigation in Florida of a scam that was investigated in another state. And frankly, nobody else was asking those questions other than journalists in Florida. And it took pulling public records to get that information. Same thing with the foreclosure. When those investigators were ousted, we needed to ask. There's no big money behind that, right? There's no big money behind victims who's going to lobby and get this information. And I just believe journalists have an obligation to do that. I'm fortunate to work for an organization that does not have limits, as long as I get everything right. And we do work like hell to get everything accurate. Newspapers are not what they used to be. by a long shot. I'm working with a staff about a tenth of the size as when I joined the Sentinel over a quarter century ago. But I still believe in what I do. And as long as they let us continue telling the truth, I think we have to do it, and we have to do it without intimidation.
Scott, how can our listeners follow your work?
Well, I appreciate you asking that. I write for the Orlando Sentinel, so I do it three times a week. It's orlandosentinel.com. You can always just Google Scott Maxwell and Orlando Sentinel. It will come up. All my columns are placed there. There is no shortage of nonsense and scandal to write about in the Sunshine State. Carl Hiaasen one time said that the problem for Florida fiction writers is you can't create fiction that is more absurd than the state's reality. So columnists like myself stay pretty busy.
Scott, we're so grateful that you joined us today on Law and Disorder. And beyond today, we're grateful for the kind of independent journalism you do every day. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me and for talking about these important issues.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Last week, President-elect Donald Trump named Andrew Ferguson as the next chair of the Federal Trade Commission. He replaces Lina Khan, a vocal critic of big tech. Ferguson is already one of the FTC's five commissioners, currently consisting of three Democrats and two Republicans. Antitrust laws, as listeners may know, are designed to promote fair competition by prohibiting monopolies, unfair restraints on trade, and other behaviors that harm consumers or that stifle innovation. The FTC plays a key role in enforcing these laws. It investigates businesses for anti-competitive practices, reviews mergers and acquisitions for potential harm to market competition, and also takes legal action to prevent or rectify any violations. With Trump's recent nomination of Gail Slater as the Justice Department's Assistant Attorney General for Antitrust, some predicted that the incoming administration may continue Lina Khan's tough stance on companies like Google and Apple. But many leading Republicans prefer a more business-friendly approach to antitrust enforcement that would avoid hampering big tech's deal-making and acquisitions. Other top contenders for the FTC chairmanship were Melissa Holyoke, a Republican commissioner and former Utah Solicitor General, along with Mark Meador, a former DOJ and FTC official who previously advised Mike Lee on legislation that would actually target big tech. Trump also announced last week that he'll nominate Meador as the third Republican commissioner of the FTC. To discuss what Ferguson's appointment might mean for tech giants is Laurel Kilgore from the American Economic Liberties Project in D.C. Laurel leads the project's team of policy analysts and experts to produce research and policy briefs with a focus on antitrust issues impacting our economic liberties. Laurel, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Heidi. It's great to be here.
As you know, since the 1980s, deregulation, lax merger enforcement, and laws that shield big tech from accountability have allowed monopolies to thrive. Tell us the role that the FTC and the Department of Justice play in helping to curb corporate monopolies.
So the FTC and the DOJ play the leading role in enforcing antitrust laws in this country. So those are the agencies that took on some of the most powerful monopolists in the country. So Standard Oil in 1911, Alcoa, Paramount Studios in Hollywood, IBM, AT&T, the Microsoft case in the 1990s. There are other agencies in government that have some competition authority, like the Department of Transportation can stop mergers. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has some competition authority. But the FTC and the DOJ are really the ones who set the pace and have the most litigation expertise. So they're very important in enforcing antitrust laws. And they have overlapping authority. So typically, they have a deal between them to split up industries. So I'll focus on cloud computing, you focus on farm equipment, and so on. So it's like a friendly agreement between them. And both of them have the ability to review proposed mergers under the Clayton Act. Both can litigate against monopolization and restraints of trade under the Sherman Act. Both agencies even file amicus briefs and lawsuits involving states or private parties to express the government's view on law and policy. There are some differences, though. So only the DOJ can bring criminal cases, and the antitrust statutes do include the potential for criminal penalties and even jail time. And only the FTC has a very broad, unique authority to challenge conduct that violates the spirit of the antitrust laws, but maybe not the letter. It's called an unfair methods of competition authority. So that was sort of explicitly written by Congress as a sort of catch-all authority. The FTC also has this additional consumer protection rule where it targets unfair or deceptive acts or practices, and the FTC can conduct in-house administrative proceedings where an administrative law judge holds a trial. So the FTC also has investigative powers, so it can study and learn about an industry before it decides to take action. It also has rulemaking authority where it takes public comments and then writes rules to implement statutes.
Laurel, under Lena Khan's leadership, how effective has the FTC been in holding tech giants like Facebook and Google accountable? She's brought a number of high-profile merger challenges, but have they been successful?
Well, they've been successful lately when you're talking about merger enforcement generally. So the FTC just blocked the largest grocery merger in history in the Kroger-Albertsons deal, and also blocked a deal in the handbag market in Tapestry and Capri. But early on, there was a high-profile loss against Facebook that tried to block its acquisition of Within Unlimited, which was it's a startup that offers subscription-based virtual reality fitness services. There was also a loss that's currently under appeal where the FTC unsuccessfully tried to block Microsoft's acquisition of Activision, which makes Call of Duty. So that was the largest video game deal in history. But the point I would make here is that you don't get adequate enforcement of the laws if you only take on cases that you're sure you will win and you never try new legal theories that adapt to new market realities. So there was a book that was written by Jesse Eisinger, a journalist who's a Pulitzer Prize winner, called The Chicken Shit Club, which exposed kind of this culture of cowardice within certain agencies like the FBI, the SEC, and especially the DOJ, that kept them from holding America's financial institutions accountable for their crimes during the financial crisis. And so some of the philosophy of the current leaders of the agency are a reaction to that failure of enforcement. And to talk a little bit more specifically about what happened with those deals, so the Within deal, the court actually credited the viability of the FTC's theory that a monopolist violates antitrust law when it has an actual or perceived potential competitor in a new market, like virtual reality. So the court affirmed the theory, it just found that the evidence was insufficient in that particular case, but it is helpful to confirm that theory for future cases going forward. And then in the Microsoft Activision case, I think that was something that was badly reasoned, and you can see that from the aftermath of the deal, where it's led to layoffs of 1,900 people. There was a 17% year-over-year price hike for a game subscription. They also discontinued a cheaper product. So those types of harms that you see when mergers are anti-competitive actually happened. And one of the more disturbing aspects of that decision was that the judge, Jacqueline Scott Corley, did not recuse herself, even though her son works for Microsoft. So I think there were some significant problems with that case. Opening the lens a little bit wider, we recently put out a report that was comparing Biden's enforcers to previous enforcers and found that they were four times bolder in terms of the number of billion-dollar mergers that they actually brought all the way to trial. So like the biggest cases, they were much bolder in bringing. They won the first criminal monopolization case in over 50 years, the first ever criminal case against an employer for using no-poach agreements. They filed 2.5 times as many monopolization cases, and they won the first major monopolization case in a generation, and that was a big tech case against Google. So very, very important shift in philosophy and results overall in the antitrust enforcers at the FTC and the DOJ.
That's impressive. Critics have argued that Lina Khan's approach has been too theoretical, too academic. How does Andrew Ferguson's background compare or contrast with hers?
Yeah, so you're right to highlight Lina Khan's academic work because she has done very important and influential academic work. So her article on Amazon's antitrust paradox debunked kind of the reigning orthodoxy for the past 40 years, which basically said that if there are no, you can't forecast any short-term increased price effects through fancy economic models, then the merger is likely to be good or the monopolization is likely to be good. And she sort of disproved that through the way that Amazon built its empire through lax enforcement of predatory pricing laws. And she's had a number of other articles that have been very influential about the relationship between market power and inequality. She had an article called The Separation of Platforms and Commerce, which kind of drew on lessons from railroads and telecom and banking for thinking about how we can structure markets that involve digital platforms. She also had a paper with Rohit Chopra in 2020 where that prepared her for what her vision and direction was in leading the agency and how the FTC could use its unfair methods of competition rulemaking authority in a way to do things like ban non-compete agreements. Another thing that's sort of important to understand about her background is that she started as a business journalist before going to law school. So she started out going to people in a bunch of different industries like chocolate makers, chicken farmers, and understanding how these markets actually worked. So not looking at theoretical economic models, but listening to people and listening to the fear they felt when they were coming up against market power. She also spent some time with the House Judiciary Committee. She was part of this massive investigation into big tech specifically. So she had a lead role in that. It was a 16-month investigation. They reviewed over a million documents from big tech companies. They held 7 hearings to understand the impact on competitors and the market, the impacts on things like free press, innovation, privacy, and then also had a hearing on solutions. So that was a very influential report as well. So she does have a somewhat different experience. She doesn't come from big law. She doesn't come from a litigation background, but her staff does have that litigation experience. And she has had a good working relationship with Jonathan Cantor, Assistant Attorney General at the DOJ, who does have that very hardcore litigation background. And as you mentioned, Ferguson does have a different background that's more traditional as a resume for that position. So he clerked for Supreme Court Justice Thomas. He served as Solicitor General of the Commonwealth of Virginia. He worked at several DC law firms. And he occupies sort of an interesting position between coalitions within the Republican Party. So on the one hand, he was chief counsel to Mitch McConnell, very much of sort of the old guard establishment. But he has also embraced a lot of MAGA talking points. And some of his dissents are in line with Project 2025 goals around reducing the governing power of the administrative state. So that's started to show up in a lot of his dissents and concurrences in the agency. Even going as far as asserting that the FTC's power to hold in-house hearings is unconstitutional, which is, you know, quite a bold thing for someone who is a commissioner in the agency to assert that part of his own agency is unconstitutional. So that's quite unusual. But he does have some background in wanting to hold big tech accountable for violations. So that is a significant aspect that may be a continuation between administrations. And I think it is important to note that the big tech cases, the first big tech cases for monopolization against Google and Facebook were brought in the waning days of the first Trump administration, so under Trump's attorney general. So there is some continuity of this thread between the first Trump administration, the Biden administration, and now this new Trump administration.
The new chairman appointed by Trump, Andrew Ferguson, is expected to appoint new directors of the FTC Antitrust and Consumer Protection Divisions. Might his changes be more favorable to business? And if so, how?
Yeah, so that's a good question, but I think we need to question the framing a bit, because when you say favorable to businesses, which businesses, right? So many of these dynamics are about one monopolist acting as a gatekeeper who controls a choke point that's key to an entire industry, or one player with dominant market share abusing or squeezing out other players. So it's not pro-business overall to go easy on monopolists. Ultimately, you know, that leads to stagnation, abuse in industries. And so I think in terms of what we'll see, you know, I think there will be a difference between Biden enforcers and the enforcers under the FTC and whoever Ferguson appoints. So you may see more of an industry by industry approach. So there may be, you know, continued scrutiny of big tech, also certain other abusive players like pharmacy benefit managers, but you may see less scrutiny in other industries, and you may see a bit more permissiveness in terms of mergers.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm Heidi Boghossian, and I'm joined by my co-host, Steve Rohde. Laurel, the Department of Justice recently won a major antitrust trial where a federal judge found that Google illegally maintained a search monopoly with their search engine. What's the significance of that decision, and what will happen next? Will Google be broken up?
I mean, it really is the revival of antitrust law as a serious law enforcement. So this is the first major win since the Microsoft case. It ended a two-decade drought in that type of enforcement. So it really proves that there was sort of this backlog of cases that enforcers just were not pursuing. And so this was a very major win for the Department of Justice to finally get a verdict against Google. And now we're sort of in the remedies phase, where we're thinking about how we can open up the search market into competition, especially in this era where AI is becoming kind of a gateway to search and influencing search, and making sure that all of those innovative new AI companies are not going to be, sort of choked off by Google.
Well, judges in that case expressed shock that Google's lawyers may have destroyed or hidden evidence. I understand your organization has petitioned the California State Bar to launch an investigation into that. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so this is a pretty shocking conduct that has impacted at least five different court cases and counting. So it first came up a long time ago in a copyright case involving Viacom, but more recently in these antitrust cases against Google. So basically, what was uncovered was that Kent Walker, who was Google's general counsel, wrote this memo in 2008 that warned employees against basically putting anything into writing or preserving evidence for litigation, which is contrary to, you know, sort of the laws and rules around litigation, which is that once you're on notice that there's litigation, once you've been sued, you have an obligation to preserve anything that is in writing. And so he led this program where Google, by default, had all of their internal chats turned off to not record, and encouraged employees to shift all of their sensitive chats to being in these history off discussions, where all of the history of the chat would be automatically deleted every 24 hours. And so this is something that has reduced the amount of evidence that would show Google's business practices in a lot of cases. And, you know, several different judges have called it shocking. You know, they've said that, you know, in the search case, the judge wrote, the court is taken aback by the lengths to which Google goes to avoid creating a paper trail for regulators and litigants. It is no wonder that this case has lacked the kind of nakedly anti-competitive communications that were seen in the Microsoft case. So, you know, this is something that is very disturbing and is also against the rules of ethics for lawyers. And my organization and several others wrote a letter to the California State Bar basically saying that, you know, you need to take this type of violation seriously and make an investigation into it, just as you would any other lawyer from less powerful companies. You should be having, you know, equal application of the law and the rules of professional conduct. So this is something that's very important for the integrity of the legal profession, but also sends a signal to in-house counsel who monitor, put together their own programs for how documents are preserved and how employees are trained about their obligations during litigation. So I think it's very important to make sure that there is that sort of ripple effect in other companies taking these obligations seriously.
Laurel, if they're not held in check, what kind of threat do you believe artificial intelligence companies could pose to the public?
Well, there are a broad range of possible harms to privacy and bias, you know, treating different people differently based on their race or sexual orientation. But I think one of the biggest threats is actually their lobbying power to create an AI exception to existing laws. So there is no AI exception to anti-discrimination laws or laws against fraud or consumer protection. It's just that the courts need to learn how to apply those existing laws to the new technologies. You know, there's no AI exception for copyright, that sort of thing. You know, I think that some laws could be passed to sort of strengthen and clarify that. But I'm most concerned that some of the enthusiasm to say that we need a new AI-specific law for anything could result in, you know, lobbying that undermines existing laws. So I think that's, you know, sort of the concern there.
What other antitrust cases against big tech are still in progress right now?
One of the things that's really interesting is this under-the-radar case that's kind of been on pause for a while, which was that the Attorney General of Ohio brought a case against Google that was seeking to designate Google as a common carrier, meaning it has certain obligations to not discriminate in, you know, in terms of the information that it carries based on the person's viewpoint. This is much like, you know, a telephone company provider can't discriminate, you know, based on whatever the content of the phone call is. But that case has sort of been on hold for a number of months. And as soon as that wakes up again and we get an initial ruling on that theory, I think that will be very interesting. And that's a case that, you know, conservatives have been paying a lot of attention to. J.D. Vance filed an amicus brief in support of that case. So that could have some interesting and unexpected impacts on big tech regulation generally and how that is situated in a legal sense. There are also some other cases, so that FTC case against Facebook or Meta that was filed at the end of the Trump administration, that's still going on. There's also a case that the FTC filed against Amazon last year, so there are actually two different cases there. So there was a case about Amazon's monopolization, also a case about dark patterns, about how difficult it is to cancel Prime, some people being tricked into signing up for Prime, other people finding it very difficult to cancel Prime. Those cases are pending outside of big tech, but still in the tech industry. DOJ has a case against RealPage, which is software that makes it possible and it basically tells landlords you have to set certain high prices for rent and keep units off of the market. Otherwise, you don't get to use our services. So that's another big, important case in the tech arena.
So many cases. And we are running out of time. Laurel, tell us about the American Economic Liberties Project, where you work. Why was it founded and what is it doing?
Yeah, so it was founded in 2020 to translate some of the intellectual changes within antitrust into concrete policy results. This is something where, you know, we're concerned about America's concentration crisis, where 75% of industries have become more concentrated since the year 2000. Mm-hmm. This has led to a lot of harms like layoffs, high prices for consumers, even shortages of things like IV fluid, and also the destruction of local news. A lot of other local small businesses have been harmed as well, like a lot of independent pharmacies have closed. So we are focused on restoring the sense of economic liberty that has been a long thread of American legal tradition, basically since the founding of the country. And so we're aimed at, you know, reviving that area of thought and making sure that we translate that into policies and actually improve people's lives.
Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy's new Department of Government Efficiency claims that government is inefficient. Musk tweeted, "Delete Consumer Financial Protection Bureau." Others argue the FTC's antitrust enforcement authority, which overlaps, is redundant. Representative Ben Klein introduced a one-agency act to transfer all of the FTC's antitrust activity to the DOJ. What's behind all this?
Yeah, so this is part of a much broader attack on the administrative state and the ability of agencies to actually govern and make a real difference. This particular controversy around Musk started because the venture capitalist Marc Andreessen went on Joe Rogan's show and he attacked the CFPB. He accused it of debanking startups and trying to give big banks an unfair advantage over over startups. And that's just sort of completely backwards from what has actually happened. So the CFPB was created in the wake of the financial crisis to actually make sure that, so there were a whole bunch of, you know, duplicative and dispersed authorities among other financial regulators. And the point was to bring it all under this one house. So if you delete the CFPB, you delete all of these important authorities to protect consumers from financial scams and fraud. So this is an agency that returned $1 billion to consumers after Wells Fargo fraudulently opened a bunch of bank accounts. This is an agency that has returned over $20 billion to consumers. So deleting the agency, which would require an act of Congress, would be pretty problematic. I think that Musk is, you know, brought this up because he wants everyone to use X as their bank. So he wants to be able to extend his reach into financial services, which is something that the CFPB regulates. So I think that is his angle in attacking it. As for the One Agency Act, this is something about moving all of the FTC's unfair methods of competition authority, all of its antitrust authority over to the DOJ. So moving all of its staff, all of its powers over to the DOJ. That is something that, if it were done in good faith, might not be problematic. But I think, you know, I question sort of whether this is being proposed in good faith, given this larger project of dismantling the administrative state. And, you know, the way the act is written, I'm a little concerned about whether, you know, it sort of leaves the unfair methods of competition, this broader authority about the spirit of the antitrust laws, would reduce the ability of agencies to use that. So I don't know that the act is written well enough to protect that very important enforcement authority.
Laurel, we hate to come to the end of this session, but we're out of time. How can our listeners follow your work and that of the American Economic Liberties Project?
Yeah, so our website is economicliberties.us. I'm on Twitter at balancecrafting. I'm also on Blue Sky at balancecraft. So thank you again so much for having me. This was a great conversation.
Thank you, Lauren, for today and for everything you do every day on these important issues.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well.